He was looking for patterns. What were audiences really saying about the types of stories and characters that they liked and didn't like? And could Brucesi take their suggestions to build a prediction engine that could detect hit movies just by looking at their stories? Several links connect Brucesi and George Lucas. The first is science fiction. A leather-bound copy of Asimov's Foundation trilogy rested on the black bureau behind Brucesi in his office. His favorite character is Harry Seldon, the psycho-historian who can predict the future of the galaxy. Seldon cannot foresee what individuals will do, but he can explain the aggregate behavior of civilizations across the galaxy hundreds of years into the future. Asimov came up with the idea for psychohistory in a chemistry class. The individual molecules of a gas move quite erratically and randomly, and nobody can predict the direction of motion of a single molecule at any particular time, Asimov said. But you can predict the total behavior of the gas very accurately using the gas laws. For example, when volume decreases, pressure rises. That is not a 50-50 bet on the future of molecules. It is a scientific fact. Asimov daydreamed about the ability of a mathematician to observe entire civilizations as if in a beaker, governed by undiscovered laws of social nature. A scientist might not be able to predict the future of every little life, but he might foresee the fall of empires as confidently as a chemistry student can predict a chemical reaction. I became obsessed from childhood with the idea of being able to predict human behavior, Brucesi said. His first love, like Asimov's, was physics, which offers a cosmic version of prophecy. But I gradually became more interested in the physics of society, like Seldon, he said. Perfectly predicting audience behavior might still be in the realm of science fiction, but if you can anticipate how people behave at an early enough stage, you can change their behavior. On the wall there hung a 2013 New York Times story that anointed Brucesi a pioneer of statistical script analysis and the reigning mad scientist of Hollywood. The second link is Joseph Campbell, whose 1949 book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, is perhaps the closest any theorist has come to a universal formula for storytelling. Campbell reached back thousands of years to show that, since before human beings could write, we have been telling the same heroic story over and over, changing mostly the names and settings. In this universal myth, the seemingly ordinary man goes on a journey, crossing over from the known world to the unknown. With help, he survives several key trials only to face down an ultimate challenge. With this final victory, he returns to the known world as the hero, the prophet, the one, the son. It is the story of Harry Potter and Luke Skywalker, Moses and Muhammad, Neo in The Matrix and Frodo in The Lord of the Rings, and, of course, Jesus Christ. The specific beats of Campbell's arc aren't as important as its three primary ingredients: inspiration, relatability, and suspense. First, a hero must inspire, which means the story must begin with a flawed character whose journey leads to both victory — Frodo Baggins and Samwise Gamgee succeed in seeing the One Ring destroyed — and salvation — Frodo finds his courage, and Sam's loyalty repeatedly saves their lives. Second, it must be relatable, since audiences want to imagine themselves as heroes. That means the heroes cannot be invincible or obnoxiously eager to achieve invincibility. They have to struggle with their destiny. One does not simply walk into Mordor, after all, before accepting its charge. Third, Campbell's formula comes with prepackaged suspense. The road to glory is pockmarked with small defeats that keep audiences anxious and alert. Ultimately, what the hero's journey provides is the threat of chaotic suspense grounded in empathy. A familiar character who faces no obstacles is boring, and an incomprehensible character is confusing no matter what the challenges are. But a character plucked from the natural world to go on a supernatural adventure that leads through struggles to transcendence opens a door just big enough for the audience to step inside and feel the hero's glory as their own. The Hero with a Thousand Faces has been adapted so many times that Campbell himself has become something like a monomyth. His ideas formed the basis of the 1988 PBS show The Power of Myth, which became one of the most watched public television series ever. His formula has received the Hollywood treatment several times over, notably in a 1985 memo from the Disney story consultant Christopher Vogler, which became the screenwriting textbook The Writer's Journey. Its most recent reincarnation is Save the Cat, the modern Bible of screenwriting, which seemingly every person with a screenplay on a laptop has read, claimed to have read, or pointedly and often fictitiously, claimed not to have read, so as to seem rebellious. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Sunset Boulevard, The King's Speech, Guardians of the Galaxy, and Saw all hit the beats in Save the Cat, said B.J. Markle, the book's editor and an advisor at the screenwriting workshop it inspired. It's not that Walt Disney and his writing staff were sitting there thinking, all right, typically in a movie like this, the bad guys come in now. The point is that good storytellers intuitively understand that audiences relate to classically structured stories. The hero's journey is not a white straitjacket, uniform and constricting. It's more like a men's suit. Even if the cut is relatively standard, it leaves wide latitude for customization, rarely looks messy, and looks smart, done right. The most formulaic and ultimately predictable plots tend to be animated films, which are often critically acclaimed blockbusters. In Zootopia, Disney's 2016 animated hit, a little bumpkin bunny becomes a metropolitan police officer in a city where animals live like modern humans. After several stumbles, the eager whippersnapper proves her worth, suffers a crisis of confidence that sends her back to her family, and returns to the city to identify and vanquish the ultimate criminal. It is an ingeniously clever string of gags about motley animal species doing human jobs, elephants scooping ice cream with their trunks, sloths running the DMV, layered on top of surprisingly profound lessons about how marginalized groups are trapped by cultural expectations of their behavior. But the fundamental scaffolding of the story is a straightforward hero's journey. Joseph Campbell was not, strictly speaking, a scientist. He was a mythologist, proposing a recipe for fables and deriving its ingredients. His philosophy of stories is basically deductive, top-down. But Vincent Brucesi is a scientist, and his theory of stories is inductive, bottom-up. Brucesi studied millions of survey answers from thousands of people watching thousands of movies. It turned out that Campbell was right. There are rules to successful storytelling in popular films. The typical audience member couldn't tell you explicitly what those rules are, but collectively audiences have been telling movie makers for decades. Brucesi's grand theory will look familiar to listeners of the first three chapters of this book. Most people love original storytelling, provided that the narrative arc traces the stories we know and the stories that we want to tell ourselves. If Brucesi is a cultural scientist, he is a cinematic taxonomist. Within Campbell's epic monomyth, he's discovered hundreds of what you might call mini-myths, species within each genre class. For example, within hero movies, some heroes are born with powers, Superman, and other heroes acquire powers, Spider-Man. Some heroes are tragic, Batman, and others are boastful, Iron Man. Each of these subgenres has unique, specific narrative patterns, Brucesi says, and audiences have been subtly revealing them across decades of testing. Brucesi's first significant breakthrough was in the suspense genre. Brucesi saw that audiences respond to scary movies with a predictability that would please Harry Seldon. Horror might be the easiest genre to break down, he told me. Horror movies are either a haunting or a killer. A haunting movie has either a ghost or a demon. The demon is either randomly targeting the lead actors or summoned by the leads. These subtle distinctions can have a big effect on audience reactions. One of the main factors with a horror film is that the audience wants to put themselves in the situation, to internalize the character's fears, he said. But if the lead actors summon a demon, many audiences say they weren't so scared because they personally would never summon a demon. These distinctions also have predictable box office implications. Random, ambient terror befits a horror film. But when the killer has a known motive, it tends to be seen as a thriller, which is less of a lure for teenagers. Relatability is key to horror, but it's not the only element. Another is power. In a movie where a demon is targeting people, like Jason in Friday the 13th or Freddy Krueger in A Nightmare on Elm Street, the story is built around a simple question. Can anybody stop him? Brucesi said. That's why the trailers for these films often include a triumphant shot of the killer. Whether people realize it or not, the killer is the hero. Another genre that yields to simple classification is the apocalypse. There are two species of apocalypse movies, Brucesi says, Stop the Apocalypse and Survive the Apocalypse. In Stop the Apocalypse movies, like Armageddon and Deep Impact, a ragtag team of experts takes on the threat, and a sacrificial suicide saves the world. Even casual moviegoers acknowledge that Armageddon and Deep Impact are eerily the same movie. Survive the Apocalypse movies are more diverse, but they're also of a piece. In 2012, The Day After Tomorrow, and San Andreas, disaster strikes in the form of Mayan portent, global warming, and a massive earthquake, respectively. But despite the varieties of calamity, the central drama in these films is the same. A father is fighting to reunite with his family. Meanwhile, the selfish perish, the generous survive, and the dad makes up for his past mistakes with acts of heroism. Deep down, these apocalypse movies are all traditional family dramas about the challenges of fatherhood. Some critics say Brucesi's own version of psychohistory encourages movie makers to mimic what's come before them, which seems like a fair point. Indeed, the first time I spoke to Brucesi, I came away feeling like my favorite films weren't pieces of art, so much as feats of scalable engineering like similar homes in a neighborhood cul-de-sac based on the same architect's blueprint. But Brusesi insists that he isn't drawing blueprints at all, nor is he arbitrarily painting a bright line between good and bad storytelling. Instead, he's showing movie makers the subtle lines audiences have been drawing on their own. If writers and producers understand the boundaries of audience expectations, he says, it will make Hollywood storytelling more satisfying. Viewers are not just nostalgic, yearning for old feelings and familiarities to resurface. One might say they are also prostalgic, obsessed with predicting the future of everything and satisfied when their expectations are met in the right way. People have certain expectations about cake, Brusesi told me, in one of several metaphors he employs to explain his work. There are all different types of cake that a good baker can make, but there are also rules. For example, nobody wants a ton of salt in a cake. This is a good rule. But you can find a purposeful exception. It's called salted caramel cake. A great baker can find the exceptions because he understands the rules. The rules extend even to characters. Even though most audiences might not initially see the similarities, there is substantial overlap between the trio of Captain Kirk, Spock, and Leonard Bones McCoy in Star Trek, the trio of Harry Potter, Hermione Granger, and Ron Weasley in Harry Potter, and the Star Wars group of Luke, Yoda, Han Solo, and Leia. On the surface, these characters aren't alike and certainly don't live in the same fictional world. But in all cases, the hero is the synthesis of his friends. The thinking Spock and the feeling McCoy are two halves of Captain Kirk. The brilliant Hermione and the sensitive Ron balance out Harry Potter. Luke Skywalker combines Han's bravery and Leia's conscience. In all stories, the hero is the average of his friends, and the hero's journey is a challenge to unite these ingredients in victory. Might and right. I left Brusesi's office to have lunch with a Hollywood producer. I told him about Brusesi's theory, the surprising inflexibility of audience expectations, and the unconscious biases that shape storytelling. He smiled. "You want to know what I think is the secret of it all?" he said. "Naturally," I said yes. "You take 25 things that are in any successful genre, and you reverse one of them," he said. "Reverse too many and you get genre confusion. It's a muddle and nobody knows how to place it. Invert all the elements and it's a parody. But one strategic tweak? Now you've made something that is perfectly new, like a classic Western adventure story, but set in space." Every few years, a theory emerges from some frothy part of the internet that Star Wars was meticulously and comprehensively planned from the start, as if handed down to Lucas on the Mount, or handed down by Lucas himself. But Lucas was a student of the Johannes Brahms school of hits. Neither progenitor nor thief, he was above all an assembler, a master blender. In addition to Flash Gordon, one of the most famous early inspirations for Star Wars was The Hidden Fortress, the 1958 Japanese adventure film directed by Akira Kurosawa, in which peasants escort a princess and a general through violence to safety. But neither of Lucas's chief inspirations was perfectly original. Star Wars' ancestors were also descendants of other works. Flash was an adaptation of the 1912 pulp fiction character John Carter, created by Edgar Rice Burroughs, who also created Tarzan. Carter's character was a Civil War veteran fighting evil aliens on Mars. In the 1930s, King Features Syndicate, which owned several comics, tried to buy the rights to John Carter, but Burroughs turned them down. So King Features invented their own extraterrestrial warrior, Flash Gordon. Several decades later, when George Lucas tried to buy Flash Gordon, King Features said no and Lucas made Star Wars. Interestingly, both refusals inspired a yet more popular space fantasy franchise. John Carter's cinematic offspring are the stuff of legend. He directly inspired Flash, distantly inspired Star Wars, and reportedly inspired James Cameron's 2009 billion-dollar blockbuster, Avatar. But the 2012 film, John Carter, was a historic flop for Disney and one of the most costly cinematic catastrophes of all time. Apparently, John Carter at the movies is like an inedible goose that cannot stop laying golden eggs. Kurosawa's Hidden Fortress, too, is an echo of epics. It was loosely based on another Kurosawa film, The Men Who Tread on the Tiger's Tail, which was derived from a famous 19th century Japanese play, Kanjincho. It doesn't end there. Kanjincho was the kabuki version of an older no-style drama, Ataka, whose characters were adapted from folktales about a medieval samurai named Minamoto Yoshitsune. I am surely missing some links in this multi-millennia chain of influence, but at the very least, one can reasonably say that if Star Wars is a child of Kurosawa, it is the great-great-great-grandchild of Japanese mythology. Is it depressing that the most famous stories of modern day tend to be the latest incarnation of past generations' myths? Maybe not. Anticipation is a great pleasure of film and television, but it's not the only one, and frankly, it's probably the cheapest, the critic and author Adam Sternberg wrote in New York Magazine. In my experience, the second viewing is always more satisfying than the first, he said, because you notice all the things you missed while you were busy waiting for the twist. Not all spoilers are equal. The Sixth Sense and The Usual Suspects are carefully designed traps to spring the concluding surprise. But it hardly ruins Citizen Kane to learn that its protagonist dies. And it's still easy to appreciate the movie's genius after learning that his dying word, Rosebud, is an allusion to, spoiler, his childhood sled. One might wince at the claim that spoilers don't actually spoil many stories, but Sternberg is onto something. In the 2011 study, Story Spoilers Don't Spoil Stories, scientists asked 800 college students from the University of California, San Diego, to read mysteries and other tales by writers like John Updike, Roald Dahl, Agatha Christie, and Raymond Carver. Each student got three stories, some with spoiler paragraphs revealing the twist, and some without any spoilers. They rated their stories on a 10-point scale. Readers significantly preferred spoiled stories over unspoiled stories, the researchers concluded. A novel that can be truly spoiled by the summary of its plot is a novel that was already spoiled by that plot, the New Yorker book critic James Wood wrote. For once, the social scientists and the art critics are in unison. Every great story is more than its plot. It is a self-enclosed universe of life, or as Tolstoy wrote, a vehicle for the delivery of all feelings from sorrow to ecstasy. But if these vehicles are powered by the drama of not knowing what comes next, why might some people prefer a story when they can guess the ending? Perhaps it goes to the heart of Brusesi and Campbell's work. Audiences need an element of safe predictability in order for the feelings to hit with their full weight. Compelling stories, as one cliché goes, are emotional roller coasters. But the joy of a roller coaster isn't the imminent threat of death. It's the tension between this thing will make me think I'll die and I know exactly where I'll disembark alive. There are several ways to tell the story of how Star Wars nearly wasn't conceived, bought, or filmed. But the most fundamental near miss was that Lucas himself barely survived the streets of Modesto. He made it to his 20s by the grace of a faulty seatbelt. When he was a teenager, Lucas's father bought him a Bianchina. It was a stout Italian minicar with a short body and perky roof, like a baby turtle on wheels. Lucas outfitted it with a seatbelt from an Air Force jet and raced it around the tight corners of his hometown. The first accident flipped the car, damaging the shell so badly that Lucas tore off the roof. That was prelude to a more violent accident months later. Lucas collided with a Chevy and his car plowed into a walnut tree. The force of the crash tore his makeshift seatbelt and threw him clear through the open roof. Years later, Lucas would reflect that his luck was nearly cinematic. If he hadn't replaced the seatbelt, the tree would have killed him instantly. If he'd replaced the seatbelt without tearing the roof off, he might have broken his neck in the car. Instead, he left the Modesto hospital after 2 weeks. The crash changed his life. It gave me this perspective on life that said I'm operating on extra credit, he told Oprah Winfrey in 2012. What I'm getting is bonus material. Star Wars 2 exists only by a confluence of impossible coincidences. Several studios neglected to pick up the movie. Had King Features been kinder to the American director, Lucas would have simply made a Flash Gordon franchise. Without American Graffiti, Lucas's surprisingly successful second film, 20th Century Fox might never have agreed to distribute it. Without prodding from friends to rewrite the script numerous times, the film might have been, as some initially predicted, a disastrous jumble of nonsense plot and wooden dialogue. The very existence of the weighty Star Wars franchise hangs by a fragile cosmic thread. It was only because Lucas couldn't buy Flash Gordon or remake Hidden Fortress that he was forced to nourish his story with the 1,000 references that make Star Wars the iconic universe it is. Today, the story appeals equally to 10-year-old boys and semiotics nerds. It is simple enough to summon adrenaline from the pituitary, yet so deeply referent that it invites fans to plummet for religious significance, like a visual Talmud. Directors like George Lucas are semiotically nourished authors working for a culture of instinctive semioticians, the late and great writer Umberto Eco once wrote. That is, Star Wars is not a single movie, nor a lonely cliché floating in ether. It is movies, the gathering of hundreds of clichés from several genres celebrating a reunion in outer space. A story that alludes to just one story is derivative. A story that alludes to nothing in cinema or literature is incomprehensible. Star Wars traces the thin overlap between never before seen and, aha, I've seen this before. It is an original because it is a bundle of never before bundled allusions. Each one swings open to reveal other worlds and far-flung mythologies. Like the table it was written on, Star Wars is made of many doors. Chapter 5. The Myth-Making Mind, Part 2. The Dark Side of Hits. Why Stories Are Weapons. Any book about popularity, hits, and the media requires a story about vampires. They have haunted pop culture for centuries, from Bram Stoker's Dracula and the silent film Nosferatu, to fresher interpretations like Buffy and Twilight. But consider an equally significant vampire story, the history of real vampires. One of the most popular universal myths in the world is the belief that the dead can bring death. The threat of maliciously thirsty corpses has animated the fantasies of several civilizations, from Transylvania to China. A belief in vampires continued to haunt Europe well into the Great Enlightenment, even earning what was presumably a sarcastic entry in Voltaire's philosophical dictionary. It was in Poland, Hungary, Silesia, Moravia, Austria, and Lorraine that the dead made this good cheer. As Voltaire suspected, the dead did not make good cheer in any of those places. But until the late 19th century, most civilizations knew practically nothing about disease or decomposition. Villages were confounded by the riddles of death. Why did people seem to get sick in clusters? Why did some corpses look alive when their graves were opened weeks later? And what was with their long fingernails? The last 150 years of science have answered most of these macabre questions. We know that people die in clusters when they're exposed to a common disease. We know about rigor mortis and decomposition. But the medical examiners of antiquity were less than MD level, and farmers knew nothing of viruses. Everything about death was a mystery, and compelling myths rush toward mysteries like air into a vacuum. So in Europe, China, and Indonesia, disparate societies settled on a common story that explained all of these puzzles at once. The dead can bring death. Vampires were a plausible medical diagnosis, and a belief in the blood-sucking dead mixed with local values to create bespoke folktales, as Paul Barber explains in his history, Vampires, Burial, and Death. In Eastern Europe, the usual suspects for revenants, people returning from the dead, included the ugly, the quarrelsome, the alcoholic, the atheist, the unchaste, and all seventh children. In China, a dog or cat leaping directly over a grave could add one more vampire to the world. Albanian vampires ate intestines, while their Indonesian brethren merely drank blood. In Pomerania, the southern coast of the Baltic Sea, now perhaps most famous for its adorable eponymous dog, possible victims were advised to drink an inoculating brandy made from the blood of the dead. In the early 1700s, vampire hysteria gripped Eastern Europe, particularly in modern Siberia, Hungary, and the part of Romania known as Transylvania. The Habsburg monarchy sent officials to several towns to report on this frenzy of vampire attacks and the stakings that came with them. When these reports were translated from German, they helped to popularize the vampire folklore even among literate societies that were not seemingly overrun by bloodsuckers. The Oxford English Dictionary dates the adoption of the word vampire in English to around this time, with the earliest known occurrence in 1741. Fictional vampires are tall, thin, gaunt, sly, and patrician. Dracula is a count with a large castle, and Twilight's Edward is extremely handsome. But history's true, that is, truly believed, vampires were opposites in almost every way. Plump, dirty, loud, foul-smelling peasants, They were more Renfield than Dracula. One of the most famous official vampire reports from the 1720s in Serbia concerned an old man named Peter Blagojevitz. A few months after he passed, 9 village neighbors died following short illnesses. On their deathbeds, some claimed to see Blagojevitz, or his ghost, mount them and strangle them at night. Villagers insisted on digging up his grave to check for the telltale signs of vampirism. When a Habsburg bureaucrat went to Blagojevitz's grave with a priest to attend the exhuming of his corpse, he reported that it looked quite alive. "The body was completely fresh," he wrote. "The hair and beard, even the nails, had grown on him. I saw some fresh blood in his mouth, which, according to a common observation, he had sucked from the people killed by him." That settled things. Blagojevitz was definitely a vampire, and he would have to be re-killed. Villagers sharpened a stake and ran it through his chest with such force that blood spurted out of his ears and mouth, which seemed to offer more proof of life. Then they burned the body until it was nothing but ash and pronounced Blagojevitz and his vampire avatar really, truly, and finally dead. Stakes alone couldn't kill vampires, but scientific skepticism eventually did the trick. When Habsburg Empress Maria Theresa sent her personal physician to investigate the frenzy, the doctor concluded that vampires were an unfounded public hysteria with no evidence to support their actual existence. Following his report, she passed laws in the 1770s prohibiting the exhumation of corpses and the burning of bodies. In the next 100 years, scientists gradually realized that common illnesses like cholera were probably at the root of many vampire outbreaks. Epidemiology was advancing into the shadows of superstition and, like a beam of sunlight in so many movies, killing the undead for good. It's tempting to say that the belief in vampires was downright silly. But the truth is that vampires were a perfectly coherent story. Vampirism accounted for every observable detail surrounding death. It explained why families got sick at the same time, why friends died after friends, and why the buried dead looked the way they looked. It's not coincidence that for many centuries these myths stalked villages separated by tens of thousands of miles. The Walking Dead theory of disease answered a mystery with a narrative that had meaning, suspense, and agency. It explained the chaos of life with a spectacular tale. It empowered villagers by telling them that everybody had the capacity to fight evil, with potions, garlic, prayers, chastity, stakes, swords, and fire, and, if all else failed, sanguinary brandy. Vampires were the perfect story. A great narrative catches listeners in its slipstream. Every chapter in this book has started the same way, with a story. I'm daydreaming about Monet's water lilies in an impressionist exhibit. Raymond Loewy designs the 1950s. George Lucas writes the most commercially successful meta-myth of all time. It is the convention of this book genre to build chapters like narrative Trojan horses, wheeling out a captivating tale to hide the scientific lessons within. I would be dishonoring the first lessons of the book if I tried to break too many of the genre's conventions. But I would be dishonoring the science of the book to not warn readers against putting too much stock in a great yarn. Stories are a kind of sorcery. Like repetition and anaphora, they can seduce the myth-making mind and can suppress the kind of deeper thinking that is also quite necessary to understand the truth of things. A great story that serves the wrong purpose is a dangerous thing. In the 1980s and 1990s, Gina Davis was a model an actress, and even a semifinalist for the 2000 U.S. Olympics team in archery. She might be most familiar to American audiences as the older sister in A League of Their Own, the preternaturally gifted catcher in the World War II-era All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. Between 1986 and 1992, Davis starred in several hit movies, including Beetlejuice and Thelma and Louise, and won an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress in The Accidental Tourist. At the age of 46, she gave birth to her first child, Eliza. When Davis watched movies and TV with her daughter, she was struck by the lack of strong women in children's entertainment. As Eliza absorbed the G-rated movies, Davis would sit behind her, quietly counting female characters. The arithmetic was disappointing. Even worse was the behavior of the female characters, who seemed either hypersexualized or sidelined. "This is children's programming," she thought. "This is supposed to teach our kids about the world." But these movies seemed to only reflect old and chauvinistic biases against women. Counting characters on the couch was enough to construct a hypothesis, but Davis wanted to build a movement. In 2009, she met with Madeline DiNanno, another entertainment veteran whose career was as diverse as Davis's in its own way, spanning film, events, and marketing. DiNanno shared something else with Davis, an abiding disappointment in female role models in Hollywood. In 2009, they founded the Gina Davis Institute on Gender in Media, and DiNanno became the CEO. The goal was gender equality in children's entertainment, and not just numerical equality, but qualitative equality. One reason why sexism is pervasive and enduring, they suspect, is that children around the world are being, in their words, encultured by entertainment to see that men should be strong heroes and women should be pretty damsels in distress. Moving pictures are hardly the only influence in a young child's life, but they are a powerful one. Children spend hundreds, if not thousands, of hours of their most impressionable years watching stories that have the cumulative effect of teaching them how to behave and what is normal. Repeated exposure to sexist entertainment makes young people fluent in discrimination, so that gender bias feels as automatic as breathing oxygen. Certain skills and tastes are shaped during a sensitive period in a person's life. A child's early years are key to the development of language, motor skills, and behavior. It is far easier to learn a second language as a child than as an adult, and deaf kids who don't learn sign language in early life struggle to become proficient, even if they practice for decades. There may be sensitive periods for taste as well. Most children are born hating the flavor of broccoli. Scientists believe the vegetable evolved to produce a foul-tasting compound called goitrin so that animals wouldn't eat it into extinction. But one 1990 study found that it was possible to make young children fall in love with the bitter taste of broccoli by serving it over and over again with more pleasant foods. The good news is that getting your child to like broccoli is possible through repeat exposure. The bad news is that familiarizing broccoli is an expensive chore for parents, requiring up to 15 servings for kids to accept the bitter vegetable. Different tastes seem to have different sensitive periods. Teenagers in general are known for experimenting with all manners of identity, appearance, and pharmaceutical chemistry. The most important years for developing music tastes seem to be between the mid-teens and early 20s. By the time adults reach their early 30s, most of them stop seeking out new music entirely. A 2015 study of Spotify data pinpointed the precise year that listeners stop listening to new artists: 33. Political opinions seem to crystallize around the same time. Young people who grew up during popular Republican administrations, like Dwight Eisenhower's, lean Republican for the rest of their life, while those who grew up during Franklin Roosevelt's administration leaned left for decades. After most people are in their 20s or 30s, the soft clay of taste and ideology has hardened. The Gina Davis Foundation believes that childhood entertainment shapes adult expectations too. This is the heart of what psychologists call unconscious bias, the effortless and automatic bias that infects even the well-intentioned. Unconscious bias in media can spread like a disease. Movie makers are the carriers, film is the vector, and kids are the victims. Watching too many female characters play lesser and subservient parts subtly teaches a generation of girls to apologize about being assertive. As generations of kids grow up in the glow of stories that say women can't behave like men without being punished for it, those kids grow up to teach the next generation the same bad lesson, and the vicious cycle continues. DeNano wanted to show producers and directors just how chauvinistic the Hollywood mega myth had become. The foundation funded one study analyzing gender roles in 120 popular films between 2010 and mid-2013 in the United States and several other countries, including Brazil, China, and the UK. They paid graduate students to evaluate each speaking role or named character for demographics, sexualization, occupation, and career. They discovered 1. Less than one-third of 5,799 speaking or named characters were female. Just 29% in the U.S. 2. Just 23% of films had a girl or woman as a main character. 3. Just 14% of the 79 executives shown across the sample were female. This was almost precisely the share of female executives in the U.S. in 2014, but gender equality is one area where one would hope for art to guide life rather than imitate it. 4. Just 12 women were shown at the highest levels of local or national governmental authority versus 115 males, a gender ratio of 9.6 to 1. Since Margaret Thatcher accounted for 3 of those 12 women, just 10 unique female characters were shown in political authority out of 5,799 speaking characters. And 5, 88% of characters with a job in science or technology were men. Most troubling might be the overt and dreadfully one-sided sexualization of young female characters. Girls and women were twice as likely as boys and men to be shown in sexually revealing clothing, and 5 times as likely to be called out for their good looks. In the world of film, women account for less than one-third of the workforce, while they represent two-thirds of its sex objects. This study was no outlier. Women accounted for just 30% of all speaking or named roles in the top 100 scripted films in the United States between 2007 and 2015, according to a report from the University of Southern California. Only 20% of those female characters were between 40 and 64. In blockbusters, it seems, there are 3 types of women: doe-eyed lover, harping mother, and Meryl Streep. It is typical and reasonable to blame the absence of gender balance and racial diversity in movies on the overwhelming whiteness, maleness, and straightness of Hollywood's producers, directors, and studio executives. Indeed, this was the target of the hashtag OscarsSoWhite campaign, a public protest against the fact that for the second consecutive year, the 2016 Oscar acting nominees were entirely white. These nominations were partly a reflection of voting demographics. the members of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences were 94% white and 77% male, according to a 2012 survey published in the Los Angeles Times. But, according to Vincent Prusesi, there's another group that fights quietly against gender equality in movies. It's us, the audiences. Moviegoers hold men and women to a double standard in movies, where if women act too much like men, or if men act too much like women, test audiences complain, and producers adhere to old stereotypes, rather than fight them. Take romantic comedies, for example. The typical rom-com has three acts. In the first act, the couple explores the possibility of a relationship. In the second act, they appear to come together. But before the third act, some sort of crisis threatens to destroy the relationship. This is a key feature of storytelling because it sets up the final rush of good feelings when the couple gloriously comes together in Act 3. After this critical breakup scene, the two characters go back to their lives, their friends, or their families. If the lead male character sleeps with somebody else during this break, the audience will ultimately forgive him when he reconciles with the lead actress, Prusesi said. But if the female lead sleeps with somebody during this temporary breakup, even the women in the audience will stop rooting for her. Hollywood's formulas have created an unconscious bias in romance. For men in movies, sex and romance are separate. But if you're a woman, sex with multiple people disqualifies you from a Hollywood ending. These double standards aren't exclusive to romantic comedies. Perhaps most concerning is the expectations gap in movies about business. With a tough, effective female executive, the audience will describe her in almost strictly negative terms, Prusesi said. But if you take the same character and make him a man, he'll be described in mostly positive terms. Mean and powerful men are badass. Mean and powerful women are bitchy. With hard women, the audience wants to believe that the hard side is not the real person, he continued. So the screenwriter is encouraged to include several scenes where the female executive's steely exoskeleton cracks, and audiences can glimpse the vulnerable softness underneath. Miranda Priestly, the Machiavellian editor-in-chief played by Meryl Streep in The Devil Wears Prada, has a visible breakdown over her marriage before ultimately triumphing in the film. Compare that with another ethically dubious boss, Gordon Gekko, the oily financier played by Michael Douglas in Wall Street, who enjoys cult worship despite being a relentless and unrepentant crook. Alec Baldwin's "Always Be Closing" speech from Glengarry Glen Ross is one of the most glorious asshole moments in film history. But, according to Prusesi's research, audiences would be less inclined to embrace a foul-mouthed woman from downtown. If Prusesi is right, Hollywood storytellers are caught in a trap of their own design. Audiences expect and prefer vulnerable female characters, having been instructed by the history of film that likable women ought to be feminine. The only way to break the cycle is to break expectations. Forward-thinking writers should just write kick-ass female leads and stop asking audiences for their permission. There is a precedent for sudden and brisk cultural change on a social justice issue. In 1996, just 27% of Americans said they supported the right of gay people to wed. In 2015, 73% of people under 35 said they supported gay marriage. So in less than 20 years, the idea of marriage equality went from absurdly radical to freshly mainstream to boringly obvious. The Supreme Court recently ruled in Obergefell v. Hodges that the right of gay men and women to marry wasn't just a mild cultural preference. It was a fundamental constitutional right. It is exciting to think that even now, there may be a handful of utterly radical ideas that, in less than 20 years, will be considered so deeply obvious that few will be willing to publicly question them. Notably, the decline of anti-gay prejudice occurred among adolescents and 20-somethings. Between 1996 and 2015, support for marriage equality grew 24 points among 18 to 34-year-olds, the most of any age group, and more than twice as much as the boomer generation. This goes straight to Madeline Donato's thesis. It is easier for a young person to learn a social norm than for a middle-aged adult to change his or her mind. When people say history, they tend to mean something that really happened. And when they say story, they mean something made up. But the word story comes from the Latin historia. History is always a story, a narrative that provides both the benefits of fictional tales, temporal connectedness, a satisfying cause and effect plot, and drama with meaning, and their downsides. Indeed, many histories are essentially vampire stories, narratives so compelling that few bother to study if they're actually true. Prejudice is a story that people learn about how the world works, and new generations can always learn new ways to see the world. There is little genetic difference between an 18th century farmer who wants to decapitate vampire corpses to stop them from killing his family and his 21st century descendant who considers this behavior horrifyingly stupid. Nor is there a biological difference between somebody who came of age in antebellum Georgia and a liberal student at a college campus today, even though the former believed that blacks and gays were practically subhuman, while the latter would consider both positions abhorrent. There is no question that decades from now, audiences will look back on several modern blockbuster books and Hollywood movies as if troglodytes had produced them. Cultures evolve and surround their children in an environment that reflects familiar values. Bigots are made, not born. But deep compassion also requires teaching. And a great story can be a persuasive lesson. Several years ago, I heard a story, I hope it was true, from a friend who worked at 21st Century Fox. In the late 1990s, the world's largest television manufacturers contacted the Fox News Channel to pass along a bizarre complaint from some of the network's most devoted viewers. Older Americans who watched the conservative news outlet all day long said the Fox News logo had seared itself into the screen. Even when viewers tuned into other channels, a ghostly image of the Fox News emblem haunted the bottom corner of the picture. Today, the Fox News logo rotates slowly in the bottom corner of the screen, in part to prevent the insignia from charring television pixels. Indeed, many of us suffer from ideological burn-in, the unfortunate imprinting of biases from stories and exposure. Liberals cocoon themselves in left-leaning websites, and people who get their information from Twitter can design a news stream that perfectly suits their prior opinions. Intelligent formulas govern Facebook, Pandora, Netflix, and other media, which tailor the universe of options to fit a person's prior preferences and the favorites of her in-group. This hunt for fluency and familiarity is natural, but it leaves people open to a host of dangerous biases. The power of the press is not only to report and render judgment on important issues, but also to determine which issues are worthy of coverage in the first place. That decision of emphasis has its own consequences. In the press, familiar falsehoods can be seen as positive facts, even if they're often presented as myths. In one study of myth-busting news, old and young participants read several dubious assertions such as, "Shark cartilage is good for arthritis." It is not. Immediately after, most participants correctly identified the untrue statements as myths. But several days later, researchers checked back with their subjects and found that old